Chapter 4. The fearsome clanging of a hammer on metal wakes the newest arrivals at Vorkuta Gulag at 6 a.m. Antonina was right. It is an unmissable wake-up call. The women have taken turns putting coal in the stove throughout the night, just enough to keep it burning. Though the sun still shines through most of the night, there had been frost on the ground when they walked back after their meagre evening meal in the mess. They had all slept in the clothes they had been given the previous day. The door opens, sending in a blast of cold air. Antonina Karpovna holds the door open, watching the women run to the foot of their beds, their eyes turned to her. She nods approval. She walks up the hut, inspecting the newly sewn numbers on the women's coats. Pausing at Elena, she barks, "Do it again tonight! That's the worst needlework I've ever seen!" When she is back at the door, she turns to the two nearest girls. "Grab the buckets and I'll show you where to empty them. Tomorrow, one of you take another Zechka and show her where to go, and so on. You follow?" The two girls scamper to the toilet buckets at the rear of the hut, directly opposite Silka's bed. While Antonina and the two girls with the buckets disappear, the rest of the women stay standing, no one prepared to move. When the girls return, ashen-faced, Antonina tells them all to head to the mess for breakfast and be back by 7 a.m. for roll call. Outside, the two girls who emptied the toilet buckets bend down and rub their hands across the frost in an attempt to wash the stench and urine away. If this is the end of summer, Silka thinks, as she walks with Josie over to the mess hut, and there is already light snow on the ground and air like ice, then none of them will be prepared for what is to come. Working outdoors will be unbearable. Breakfast is a thick, tasteless gruel. Josie remembers to place her precious piece of bread up her sleeve. Like the day before, there are no vacancies at any of the tables. This time, the newcomers know what to do and lean against the walls. It is obvious the gruel cannot be drunk. The women look around. There are others using two fingers for a spoon. That will have to do for now. Roll call. This is very familiar to Silka. She only hopes with the 20 of them it will go quickly, that no one has gone missing in the night. She remembers a night standing out in the cold, all night, until an inmate was found. The ache in her knees, her ankle bones. And that was not even the worst night in the other place. Not even close. Antonina Karpovna starts calling out names. Names. I'm not a number, and yet I have a number. Silka looks at her covered up left arm, and the number now emblazoned on her brown, scratchy coat. I have a name. She answers loudly. Yes, when it is called. They are told to get into four rows of five. Groups of women file past them, each headed by a brigadier. Groups of men are also coming from the other side of the camp. Silka and Herhart fall in with them as they march to the gates that lead out of the compound. From what Silka observed on arrival, there was only one way in and one way out. A simple barbed wire fence defines the boundary. Groups of men and women swarm forward. They slow down, coming to a halt as they near the exit, and see, for the first time, the ritual of going to work each day. As Antonina's turn comes, Silka observes her approaching a guard or administrator and showing him the list of names. Antonina then beckons for the first row of women to approach. The guard walks along the row, counting out five, roughly patting them down in a search, and then pushing them onward, before doing the same with the next three rows. He nods to Antonina, who goes along with the women, telling them to keep walking behind the others. They follow a train line, occasionally tripping over the rails, thinking it will be easier to walk on them than pull their feet through the sucking mud that drains them of energy they know they will need for work. Guards walk up and down the rows of men and women trudging to the large mine that looms ahead of them. It looks like a black mountain with an opening that disappears into hell. Piles of coal tower beside small, ramshackle buildings. At the top of the mouth of the mine, they can see the wheel that is drawing coal up from the depths below. Open train carts line the track as the women get closer. As they reach the mine, those in front peel off, going to jobs and areas they are already familiar with. Antonina hands the new arrivals over to a guard before following some of the women from the other huts, who are also part of her brigade. Walking amongst the women, the guard pushes several to one side, separating them out.
"Hey, Alexei," he calls out, "come and get this lot. They look like they can swing a pick."
Another guard comes over and indicates that the 15 women should follow him. Silke, Josie and Natalia remain behind. The guard looks at them.
"Couldn't swing a bloody pick with all of you hanging on to it. Follow me."
They walk over to one of the mountains of coal, arriving just as the crane dumps a load on the top. They are showered in dust and small chunks of the hard, sharp coal.
"Grab a bucket each and start loading. When it's full, take it over to one of the carts and dump it in," he says, indicating the cart sitting on the train rails.
Others are already at work, and again, it seems a matter of following their lead. The women pick up a bucket each and start filling them with pieces of coal.
"You better go faster or you'll find yourself in trouble," a woman says. "Watch me."
The woman takes her empty bucket and uses it as a scoop, half filling it. Steadying it on the ground, she uses her cupped hands to fill it to the top. The women attempt to copy her, with varying degrees of success. They all fill their buckets before attempting to pick them up. None of them can. They are too heavy.
"Empty some out and just put in as much as you can carry. You'll toughen up the longer you do it," they are advised.
Silke and Josie can only manage half-filled buckets, which doesn't go unnoticed by the guard standing at the cart. It was one thing to carry them, another trial to lift and empty them. The guard monitoring them looks at the half-empty buckets.
"You lot don't get a break. You have to make up for being such weak bitches and get moving."
At various points, Silke sees Antonina writing in a little book, conferring with the guards, answering for her brigade's productivity. The work is so grueling that Silke, Josie and Natalia are beginning to groan and huff out loud. They watch enviously when the others get 10 minutes to down tools and take a break. There is a burning sensation across Silke's shoulders, neck and back. When the next clanging bell sounds, several hours later, buckets, picks and other tools are dropped where they are. Men and women trudge over to the train tracks, sorting themselves out as they find the others from their brigade, those they share a hut with and those from the surrounding huts. They stand, waiting to be led by their brigadiers, waiting for the signal to walk. Once they are allowed, they silently trudge back down the track, stopping again outside the compound gates. Antonina Karpovna hands her piece of paper to the administrative guard, who counts the women in. They follow Antonina back to their hut, shuffling and sore, where a few embers glow without giving off any heat. Natalia throws some coal into the stove to reignite it. Silke is amazed she can find the strength to even look at the coal, let alone lift a scuttle of it. They all fall onto their beds, pulling blankets up over their heads. No one speaks. What passes for their dinner does nothing to restore their energy. Returning to their hut, many retreat back to bed, but some hover around the stove.
"What are you looking at?"
Silke, lying on her bed, recognises the voice. Elena.
"Not your ugly face," she hears Natalia reply.
Silke pushes up on one elbow to see where the exchange of words will go.
"I'll take you out, bitch, if you don't keep out of my face." "Leave me alone, you bully. Leave all of us alone."
A defiant Natalia snaps back, standing up from her bed.
"Natalia, sit down. She's not worth it," Olga says.
Elena gives out a hiss. Exhaustion has flattened Silke. She understands the anger, the lashing out. When the rage can't be targeted at your captors for fear of death, it finds other ways out. She wonders how old Elena is, what has happened to her. Maybe it is that nothing has happened to her before, like Silke, before that other place. She'd had all the love, food, clothing, comfort she could possibly need. When it is all taken away overnight, well, no one knows how they will react. She must stop herself from thinking back. Tomorrow will be a repeat of today, and the next day, and the next week, and for Silke, the next 15 years. Despair overwhelms her. Auschwitz-Birkenau, 1943. Wrapped in a warm, full-length coat, Silke stands in the snow outside Block 25. As she had feared, her block contains women who are spending their last days on Earth, often too sick to move, the life already gone from their eyes. This is Silke's world now, and she exists within it in order to stay alive. Similarly dressed capos approach her with women and girls trailing behind, emaciated, wraith-like figures, many holding each other up. Each capo tells the women they have escorted that Silke is their block leader. They are to do as she says. They are instructed to wait outside in the cold for the SS officer who will do the roll call. Silke feels as inanimate as the snow. Her eyes blur over the bony, bowed bodies, but her feelings have been taken away. It started when Schwarzhuber placed her in that tiny room at the front of Block 25 and began his regular visits. She found she could become just a series of limbs, just bone, muscle, and skin. She didn't choose it. It just happened. She thinks it might be a bit like when she was a child and badly scraped her knee. Though she saw the blood, it took a long time to register the hurt. Silke stands there, saying nothing as she waits to be told that all the women coming into Block 25 that evening are present. Tomorrow, or maybe the next day, if the Nazis decide they have something better to do, they will all be taken to the gas chamber that looks like a little white house, and they will be killed. A senior SS officer approaches, along with the last group of 10 women. His swagger stick strikes out, randomly hitting unsuspecting women. Something breaks through Silke's glazed state, and she hurries over to meet them.
"Hurry up, you lazy good-for-nothing bitches," she calls out. "I've got them," she says to the SS officer, stepping in front of him as he is about to bring his stick down on the head of a nearby girl. Silke gives her a hard shove, sending her sprawling face first into the snow. "Get up and join the others," she screams at the girl. The SS officer watches, nods to Silke, and walks away. He doesn't see Silke bend down and hoist her arm under the girl's armpit, helping her to her feet.
"Quickly, join the others," she says more gently. Silke sees the SS officer turn back and screams out at the women.
"Get inside now! I'm staying out here freezing because you're too slow and lazy to move! Go! Go!" she calls.
Turning to the SS officer, she gives him a big smile. She follows the women inside, shutting the door behind her. The women have found places to sit or lie down, though there is barely room. Sometimes they spill over into the courtyard, stacked, like animals. Gaunt faces stare at Silke, looks of terror and helplessness. She longs to explain that if she screams at them, the SS won't come in. The words won't come. She is 16, possibly the youngest person in the room at that moment, and she will live longer than them all. She sees one woman with sick crusted across her cheek. Whatever feeling she let in a moment ago closes back over. She is as flat and blank as the snow, as the walls. As the women's noises rise, the wailing and crying, and the beating of palms on walls, the praying and calling the names of the loved and lost, Silke turns and goes to the front of the block, into her room, and lies down. The days have been long and achingly difficult. Silke is having to draw on reserves of physical strength she never knew she had. Silke and Josie have been trialling different methods for how they parcel out their bread ration across the day for best energy efficiency. At night, the women often talk about food. When they broach topics of family, home, they stay close to this, of meals shared. Sauerkraut and mushrooms, cottage cheese, sausages, pierogi, fresh fruit. Silke has to reach back years into her memory to join in, and she has to fight a feeling of envy that comes from knowing these memories are much closer for the women around her. It doesn't seem that any of them are ready to go into great detail about their arrests, about recent events, about where their families are now. Or perhaps they haven't worked out whether they can really trust one another. Though they do wonder aloud about the missing. Margareta, in particular, a young Russian woman with a round face and dimples, who Silke instinctively likes, cannot stop worrying about her husband. Josie thinks of her brothers, and Olga, though she knows where her children are, worries she will not hear from them, will not know whether they are all right. Silke thinks about everyone she has lost, but she cannot even begin to express it. One night, Olga says to Silke, "Klein, that's quite common as a Jewish surname, isn't it?" Silke nods. "I suppose it is." She stands. "I'll go and get the coal." As the women return from work 1 week into their stay, Elena announces that Natalia is to empty the shit buckets tomorrow for the second day in a row. The first heavy snow has begun, and as Elena says this, she snuggles down tighter into her coat. "I'll do it," Josie says. "It's been a while since my turn." "I'm in charge here," Elena says, standing. "I'll say who does what."
"No, you're not," Josie fights back.
"No one put you in charge. We'll share the work." Silke is surprised when Elena doesn't continue the exchange. She simply narrows her eyes and sits back down, huddled in the coat. The women stand around the stove, letting the heat ease their aching muscles, waiting for the clanging on metal to indicate that it's time to go to the mess for dinner. From behind, Josie is violently shoved in the back. She reacts by raising her hand, reaching for something to brace herself against, and it lands on the stove flue. Her scream echoes off the walls. Josie holds her arm out like it's something she wants to shake off. A thousand thoughts run through Silke's head, images of sick and injured women and what happens to them. No, not Josie. Silke grabs her, propelling her out of the building, burying her burnt hand in the snow that now covers patches of the ground outside. Josie hisses through her teeth and starts crying audibly. "Shush now," Silke says, a little harsher than intended. After a few minutes, she pulls the hand from the snow and examines the damage. The palm and all four fingers on Josie's right hand are an angry red, her thumb the only untouched part. Silke pushes the hand back into the snow and turns Josie's face towards her. It is starkly pale, as white as the ground. "Stay here, I'll be right back." Silke storms back inside, pausing, staring at the women gathered around the stove. A plaintive, "How is she?" goes unanswered. "Who did this? Who pushed her?" Silke had only seen the quick movement of Josie ejected from the huddle, falling. She has her suspicions, though. Most of the women look away, but Silke notices Natalia glance towards the culprit. Silke walks up to Elena, sitting snug on her bed. Elena snarls at Silke.
I could break you in two.
Silke understands the difference between an empty threat, a display of power born of helplessness, and a true intention to harm others.
Plenty of people scarier than you have tried to break me, Silke says.
And I've fought men 10 times your size, Elena says.
The women around them move away, giving them space, certain a fight is about to start.
Get up, Silke demands.
Elena continues staring defiantly.
A fire is flaring inside Silke. I will ask you one more time. Get up.
The two women face off for several moments before Elena slowly stands up, pouting her lip a little, like a child.
Elena, I am going to take your blanket off. Hope the sheet underneath is not riddled with lice and tear the end off. You will not try to stop me. Do you understand?
Elena huffs, but nods slowly. The other women have closed the space again, standing behind Silke now that the dynamic has revealed itself to be in her favour. With one eye on Elena, Silke pulls the blanket free. She takes the bottom of the sheet and brings it to her mouth and tears at it with her teeth until she has made a small rip. Using her hands, she pulls a strip free.
Thank you, Elena. You can remake your bed.
Silke turns to the doorway. Antonina Karpovna is standing there, her arm against the doorframe, barring Silke from leaving.
Am I going to have trouble with you? She asks.
Нет,
Silke answers her in Russian. Antonina removes her arm. Silke walks back outside, where Josie sits in the snow as the sun goes down, her body rocking from the cold and pain. Silke wipes the snow from her injured hand before wrapping it in the torn sheet. Helping Josie to her feet, her arm around her, she steers her back inside. It feels strange to be so close to someone. The last person she had voluntarily touched like this had been Gita. Those gathered around the stove move aside to let them get as close as they can to the warmth. The dinner alarm sounds. Josie refuses to leave her bed. Silke feels a beat of frustration, anger at her helplessness. She almost leaves her there. Then she thinks of how much worse it would be if Josie doesn't eat, loses strength.
Josie, come on, she says, and helps her up.
In the mess, Silke hands Josie her mug of soup. She takes it in her left hand. When a chunk of stale bread is thrust at her, Josie can't accept it. It falls onto the floor. A mess guard watches, waiting to see what Silke, next in line, will do. If she helps, she can probably expect to be punished. If she doesn't, Josie's strength will suffer. Josie bends down, holding tight to her mug, looking pleadingly to Silke to help. With their eyes connected, Silke places her own piece of bread between her teeth, holding it there. A silent instruction. Josie carefully puts her mug on the floor, picks up the piece of bread, and grips it between her teeth, before picking up her mug and moving on. Once they find a place to stand, away from the guard's stare, Silke takes the piece of bread from Josie's mouth and helps her tuck it up the sleeve of her coat. Back in the hut, the subdued women all ask Josie how her hand is. She bravely tells them it will be all right. Silke is glad that eating has made her more hopeful. Sitting on her bed, Silke watches as the snow turns liquid on the outside of the window, tears running down the glass. She asks Josie to show her her burned hand. Carefully, she unwinds the makeshift bandage, the last layer sticking to the blistered skin. Josie shoves her other hand in her mouth to keep from crying out in pain.
It looks better, she says, trying to comfort Josie with the words she doesn't believe herself.
She knows how important it is to not give up. Natalia comes over and sits down beside Silke, looking at the wound. I'll ask Antonina tomorrow if there is a hospital or sick bay here. If there is, they will be able to help you and put a proper dressing on it. Silke knows anyone wanting to get out of work won't be looked kindly upon. But if Josie's hand doesn't heal, things will be much worse. She nods. Thanks, Natalia, says Silke. They all settle in their beds. The night envelops them, but dawn still arrives early and Silke wakes with a jolt, heart racing, before the silence and stillness puts her back to sleep. Antonina arrives in the morning, looking tired. She wordlessly indicates for them to get moving. Natalia goes to say something about Josie but catches Silke's shake of the head. As they walk, Silke whispers, "Let her have breakfast first, otherwise she might miss out." She's also very aware of Antonina's mood. She has learned to read the faces of captors, guards, those with power over the rest. When all names have been checked off at roll call, Natalia looks over to Silke. Silke and Josie have had their gruel, and both have bread tucked up into their sleeves. Antonina's face has a little more colour too. Silke nods to Natalia.
"Excuse me, Antonina Karpovna," says Natalia.
Silke hears the formal use of first name and patronymic. The brigadier gives Natalia her full attention.
"As you may know from your visit in the evening, Josie has acquired an injury on her right hand. Is there a sick bay she can go to?"
"How did it happen?" asks Antonina.
Natalia looks reluctant to reveal who is at fault. Despite the nastiness of the act, they don't want to get anybody thrown in the hole, the punishment cell. Starvation, disease, madness could result. Despite Silke's fury at Elena, particularly at her cowardice, a push in the back, she thinks she deserves another chance. It seems Josie does, too.
"I tripped near the stove," Josie says, "and put my hand out to break my fall."
Antonina beckons Josie over to her, chin raised. Josie approaches the brigadier, her bandaged hand outstretched.
"How do I know you're not just trying to get out of work?"
Josie understands her. She begins unwrapping the bandage. She can't stop the tears that accompany the pain as she removes the last layer, revealing the raw, blistered hand. Silke steps forward so she's beside Josie, not wanting to stand out, but wanting her to know she is there, to comfort her. Antonina looks at the two of them, sizing them up.
"There's not much to either of you, Zechkas, is there?"
She looks at Silke.
"Take her back inside, I'll be back for you."
Silke is startled, worried, but she does what she's told. They hurry back inside the building, Silke casting a backward glance at the others as they shuffle off to work. The snow whips up, enveloping them, and they disappear from sight. What has she done now? Silke and Josie huddle by the stove, blankets wrapped around their shivering bodies. Silke desperately hopes they will acclimatise. It's not even winter yet. An icy blast smacks them from their contemplation. Antonina stands in the doorway. Silke nudges Josie and they walk quickly to the door and follow Antonina out, Silke making sure the door is securely closed behind her. She has often seen Antonina with another brigadier, with whom she shared a hut in the cluster of huts that make up their brigade, so she supposes they must share responsibility for the women. Or perhaps the other woman was an assistant to Antonina. Either way, she must be the one keeping track of the brigade in the field, while Antonina takes on this duty. While the distance to the sick bay and hospital is not far, the blizzard conditions make walking slow and painful, as the snow is so deep they are forced to push their legs through it, rather than take steps. Silke tries to gain an understanding of the size of the complex by the number of huts that resemble theirs. The other, larger buildings that stand a little apart must be administration or stores, but there is nothing to indicate their use. The hospital building Antonina points out to them also has no outward sign of its purpose. A guard stands outside. Antonina, her eyes barely visible, is forced to remove the scarf wrapped around her face and shout into his face. Silke wonders what he can possibly have done to be punished with this duty. It doesn't seem much better than being a prisoner, though he probably has better living quarters and more food. With apparent reluctance, he opens the door and pushes the women unceremoniously inside. Presumably, he is under instruction not to let any snow in. The warmth of the building hits them immediately, and they unwrap their scarves, Josie using her good hand. "Wait here," Antonina tells them. They stand just inside the door, taking a first look at the room they have just entered. It is some kind of waiting room. Prisoners, men and women, sit on the few available chairs, with more on the floor, hunched over, pain etched on their faces. Others are curled up, sleeping, unconscious. Dead. It is not obvious which. Several groan quietly, a distressing sound, a too familiar sound for Silke. She looks away from them, up at the portrait of Stalin on the wall. Antonina is at the desk at the front of the room, speaking quietly to the matronly figure seated behind it. With a nod of her head, she returns to Silke and Josie. "You are number 509 when it is called." She repeats the numbers slowly in Russian. 509. Without further word, Antonina walks back to the door and is replaced by a sheet of fresh snow, which quickly melts into the puddle on the floor. Silke takes Josie's arm and steers her to a small patch of bare wall they can sit against. It is only as they slide down to the floor that Silke notices several heads lift and fearful eyes appraise the newcomers. Is there a hierarchy, even here? Silke meets their stares. They look away first. Silke hears their number, accompanied by some yelling. She startles from a daze.
"Last chance,"
the matronly woman is saying. Disorientated, she sees that Josie is asleep, her head resting on Silke's outstretched legs.
"Here, we're coming,"
she calls as loudly as she can. She shakes Josie and they scramble to their feet, heading quickly to the desk and the scowling woman behind it. She stands, thrusts a clipboard at Josie and walks to a door leading to the back of the room. Silke and Josie follow. Through the door, the woman leads them past beds that line both sides of the room. A ward. Silke glances at them. The sheets are white. The blankets grey but possibly thicker than those they have in their hut. Pillows are tucked beneath the heads of the men and women lying there. Through the ward, they enter a clinical area screened off from the rest of the room. The smell of disinfectant assaults their nostrils. Josie is shoved into a chair next to a table laden with bottles, bandages and instruments. The woman indicates the clipboard Josie is holding and hands Silke a pen. Silke understands that they are to fill it out. The woman turns away and is gone.
"I can't do this," Josie whispers. "I write with my right hand."
"Let me," says Silke. She takes the clipboard, pushes some of the instruments on the table to one side and places it down. And then she sees it is in Cyrillic script. The letters are like tunnels and gates, with surprising added curves and flourishes. It has been a long time since she has read it. Writing in it would be difficult. "Right then," she says. "The first entry is always your name. What is your family name, Josie?"
"Kotetska. Josefina Kotetska."
Silke writes the name slowly, as best she can, hoping the doctors will be able to read it.
"Let's see, I believe this is date of birth.
November 25th, 1930. And this asks for your place of residence."
"I don't have an address anymore. They arrested my father after he missed a day from work. He was a forest worker and he went looking for my brothers who had been missing for 3 days. They arrested my mother next. My grandmother and I were so afraid, all alone together in our house. And then they came and arrested us too."
Josie looks pained.
"No one in my family lives there now."
"I know, Josie." Silke puts a hand on Josie's shoulder. She was the same age when everyone was taken away from her, too. They put me in prison. Josie begins to cry. They beat me, Silke. They beat me and wanted to know where my brothers were. I told them, I don't know, but they refused to believe me.
Silke nods to show she is listening. It's strange how and when the past wants to reveal itself, she thinks. But not for her. There is no way she could find the words.
Then one day, they loaded me and my grandmother onto a truck and took us to the train station, and that's when I met you.
I'm sorry that I've brought it all up, Josie. She
looks down at the form. No, it's all right, Josie says. She looks up at Silke. Will you tell me why you're here? All I know is that you are Slovakian, and that woman on the train said she'd been with you somewhere. Did your family get arrested too?
Silke's gut clenches.
Perhaps another day.
And you knew what to do when we got here.
Josie's brow furrows, puzzling.
Silke ignores her, makes out she is studying the form again.
Silke and Josie hear someone behind them and turn to see a tall, slim, attractive woman wearing a white lab coat, a stethoscope hung around her neck. Golden yellow braids encircle the back of her head and her blue eyes crinkle at the edges in a smile. She looks at their faces and immediately addresses them in Polish, a language they can both understand.
What is it I can help you with?
Her accent is unlike any Silke has heard. Josie goes to stand up.
No, sit. Stay sitting. I take it you are the patient.
Josie nods.
And you are?
I'm her friend. I was asked to stay with her.
Are you having trouble with the form?
We were getting through it, Silke says. And then she can't help asking,
how did you decide what language to address us in?
I've been a doctor for a long time in the camps and I've learned to make a good guess. The doctor smiles warmly and confidently, the first open face Silke has seen since she arrived here.
Let me look, she says, taking the clipboard from Silke.
Well done.
Silke blushes.
Why don't you finish filling it out? I'll read you the questions.
In Russian.
Do you know any Russian?
I can speak it, but writing is a little more difficult.
Okay, I think you should continue in Russian in that case.
Yes, the quicker you learn it, the better in here.
What other languages do you know?
Slovak, Czech, Polish, Hungarian, and German.
The doctor tilts her head.
I'm impressed, though she says it quietly.
The next question on the form is, what is the purpose of your visit to the hospital?
She asks it in Russian.
Silke goes to write something.
The doctor looks over her shoulder.
Close. Why don't you try asking the patient and then writing down what she says?
Silke feels panicked. She's not sure if the doctor is playing a game with her. Why is it that she always stands out, no matter how hard she tries not to?
She asks Josie in Russian.
Josie looks at her, puzzled.
Silke tries to write burned hand in Cyrillic on the form.
Not bad, the doctor says. Enough of that for now. I can take care of the rest. I had better take a look at the patient.
Josie holds out her hand. The doctor pulls a nearby chair in front of her and gently starts unbandaging.
Who wrapped this up for you?
Silke did.
The doctor turns to Silke.
And you're Silke?
I made her hold it in the snow for a while first, then got some sheeting and wrapped it as best I could.
Well done, Silke.
Now let's have a look at the damage.
With the bandage removed, the doctor turns Josie's hand over, examining it closely.
Wiggle your fingers for me.
Josie makes a painful attempt to wiggle her fingers, the swelling preventing much movement.
It was very lucky you had someone with you who knew to get something cold onto the burn straight away. That has saved you from a far worse injury. As it is, you have what looks like a first-degree burn to 50% of your hand and 80% of your four fingers. Your thumb seems all right.
She looks up into Josie's face.
You'll need daily dressings for 2 weeks, and no work is to be attempted inside or outside.
She turns to Silke. Pass me that tube, the one that says Marjot Azurgov.
Burn cream.
Silke hands her the tube of cream, taking the top off as she does so. Gently, the doctor applies the cream to Josie's hand. Now look on the shelf behind you and find me a large bandage. Silke does as she is told, handing back the correct item. It is expertly wrapped around Josie's hand, the end placed between the doctor's teeth as she tears a small section in two, tying the ends together to hold it securely. Now hand me that pad and pen on the table. I'd better write a note. Silke watches as she writes, folds the note, and gives it to Josie. I have written here just what I said. You are not to work inside or outside and are to come here every day for at least the next 2 weeks to have the dressing changed. We will see how you are healing after that time. Now, Silke, the doctor says, I am impressed that you were so helpful to your friend, and your writing is not as bad as you think. She studies Silke. You have a capacity for languages. You know, we are understaffed here at the hospital with these new intakes. Would you like to work here? Silke realizes the opportunity. In a camp, there are the bad jobs, the outdoor, manual labour jobs, and then there are the good jobs. In the other place, a good job meant more food and warmth, but in Silke's case, it also meant being repeatedly and incessantly used and witnessing the very worst conditions in the camp. Her role as leader of Block 25 was a punishment, but one she also still feels she needs to repent for. For surviving. For trading food. For cigarettes. For warm clothes. While the women came in and out and went off to die. And in and out. And in and out. Ceaselessly. She is dumbstruck. Again, she wonders why she always stands out. She looks at Josie, feeling that if she says yes, she will be betraying her friend. She will be betraying all of the women in the hut. Josie says, Of course she will. Silke looks at her. Josie nods encouragement. If Silke refuses, will she be put in the hole? Maybe, at least, the job would mean she can smuggle more food to those who need it, or trade it for cigarettes, boots, coats for the others. The doctor looks confused. Silke supposes no one would ever say no. I don't think I can, she says. I'm sorry, says the doctor. We all must work. And I am happy to work at the mine, she says, but she hears how flat her voice is. Once she had thought she deserved more, or better, but she knows there is always a very great cost. Well, says the doctor, how about for the next 2 weeks when Josie comes for her treatment, you help me, and then you can decide. Josie raises her eyebrows at Silke, encouraging her. Silke slowly nods. Yes, thank you, doctor. But what about Josie? Let's worry about Josie in 2 weeks. I'm sure we can find suitable work for her. In the meantime, I'm going to write you a note to give to your brigadier. You are to come here every day bringing Josie. She will return to your hut after we have done her dressing, but you will stay on and work. The doctor scribbles out another note, tears it off, and hands it to Silke. Now, both of you, go back to your hut and rest.
Excuse me, asks Silke. But what do we call you?
I'm Dr. Kaldani. Yelena Georgievna. You may address me by either, she says.
Thank you, Yelena Georgievna, both girls chorus.
They follow her back through the ward. The moans and cries of the patients make the hairs on Silke's neck stand up. She will do what she's told. They pass through reception, head back out to the cold and the slog back to their hut.
Chapter 5. I know you're cold, Silke says to Josie, but I think we should save the coal until the others come home. I'll just add enough to keep it burning. She wonders if she's already trying to make up, somehow, for the fact that she will be warmer than the other women for the next 2 weeks. Silke ushers Josie onto her bed, tells her to wrap the blanket tightly around herself. After placing a small amount of coal into the stove, Silke lies down and looks across the small gap separating her from Josie. She studies the young girl's face. Cold, fear, pain and confusion distort her features.
Move over.
Silke sits and then lies down next to Josie, knowing it will be comforting to her. Within moments, she and Josie are both asleep. They are woken by a gust of freezing air and the groans of the others returning. The women push and shove to get close to the stove, removing wet boots and wiggling toes in front of it.
"Well, look, he spent all day in bed," says Elena.
All the women look in their direction, sooty-faced. Silke can feel their anger, their tiredness, their envy. Natalia comes over to them.
"How's her hand?"
Silke moves off the bed, reaches under the blanket and pulls Josie's hand out for Natalia to see. "She will need the bandage changed every day for 2 weeks," the doctor said.
"Does that mean she doesn't have to work?"
Hannah, a newer arrival, a wiry woman who has been sticking close to Elena, calls out from the pack around the stove.
"Of course it does," says Silke. "She can't even feed herself properly. How do you expect her to work?"
"Well, at least you have no excuse," Hannah says.
"Back with a bucket of coal in your hands tomorrow. Won't that be a treat for you?"
Elena says, "I'm so tired, I just want to sleep and never wake up." The door opens before Silke can say anything, and Antonina is standing there. All eyes turn to the door. The women rush to the end of their cots. Josie struggles to her feet, taking her place. Antonina walks past the women to Josie and Silke's beds. All eyes follow her path.
"Well?"
Silke says, "Excuse me, Antonina Karpovna, can I get the notes from under my pillow?" She nods. Silke produces the notes and hands them over. Antonina first reads the one describing Josie's condition and her need for daily dressings and no work. She pauses, squints at Josie's hand, and nods. Then she reads the second note, looks at Silke, and reads it again.
"You just scored the best seats in the house. Congratulations."
She passes the notes back to her, bemusement on her broad face.
"All out! Line up!"
The women head back outside, falling into two neat rows. They follow Antonina to the mess. Dinner awaits. The snow has stopped falling but is thick on the ground. They trudge through it. Silke is keeping her head down and her hat low, but Elena and Hannah catch up to her.
"You're going to have to tell us what the note says," Elena hisses through her scarf.
Silke doesn't say anything. And then Natalia says, in a more polite tone,
"We are curious, Silke."
"Well, I didn't say yes," Silke says, "but they're short in the hospital and they asked me to work there." Elena gasps.
"You lucky bitch."
Hannah glares at Silke.
"She said no," Josie says, "but the doctor is making her do a trial."
"Why didn't you say yes?" Natalia asks.
"Scared of needles?" Silke tries,
a joke, to deflect the tension. Olga, who has been watching all the while from a distance, sniggers. Josie says,
"She didn't want to have a position higher than us. Honestly, I heard her try to refuse."
"That's madness," Natalia says. "Any one of us would say yes."
They've almost reached the mess. Silke feels the knowledge sinking in for them all, even Elena and Hannah, that now she will have access to better food, warmth, materials. By accident, again, Silke is in a position of more unwanted power.
"I'll try to save Josie's bandages," she says, "when they're changed, so you can wrap your feet, your heads, for work."
"You better," Elena says. At the mess, the women all file off and eat their watery soup and stale bread. She notices that Elena keeps looking at her, whispering to Hannah. Josie says to Silke,
"It will be all right. Maybe we'll all find good jobs.
She is staring off into the middle distance, no doubt imagining a rosier future. Silke is glad she can maintain this optimism. It will keep her strong. 9 o'clock is observed by the lights going out, the women already in their beds. The searchlight outside advances into the hut, along with a shower of snow. The door is open. Several women raise their heads to see the cause. Boys and men, old and young, are pushing their way into their hut. Many of the women scream, burying themselves under their blanket. If you can't see me and I can't see you, I'm not here.
We thought we'd give you a little time to settle in, says the man Silke recognises as Boris, the one who chose her. But it's bloody cold and we need some warming up. Where are you? Where's my pretty one? I've been waiting all day for my fuck. Come on, identify yourself so we can get started.
He is walking in her direction, pulling the blankets from all the women as he approaches.
I'm down here, Silke calls.
What are you doing? Josie cries out. Silke, what's happening? I'm scared.
Boris stands over Silke, smiling down.
Silke!
Yells Josie.
Shut up, bitch, before I shut you up, he says to Josie.
It's all right, Josie, it's all right, Silke says, although she is shaking.
Hey, Vadim, here's your one next to mine, says Boris. Come and get her.
Josie attempts to get out of her bed, screaming. Boris roughly pushes her back down and holds her as Vadim makes his way over to Josie. Then, stumbling, Boris sits on the edge of Silke's bed and starts taking off his boots. The smell of vodka wafts off him. Josie is quietly sobbing, a sound that tears at Silke's heart. She puts a hand on Boris's chest.
If you let me just have a few words with her, I can quieten her, she says flatly.
Every other woman is screaming and cursing as they are slapped around and forced down on their cots, but she feels responsible for Josie. She was there when she was chosen for this. She has to do what she can to protect her.
Boris gives an uninterested shrug of his shoulders, which tells Silke she can try and calm Josie.
Vadim has his hand over Josie's mouth and is tearing at her clothes.
Hold on a minute, Silke says to him firmly.
He stops, surprised. Josie, listen to me. Listen. Silke leans closer to the girl and speaks quietly.
I'm sorry. There is nothing you or I can do to stop this, or if there is, I haven't yet worked it out.
She blinks her eyes slowly. Time is distorting in the way it does when she becomes blank. Just limbs.
Silke, no, we can't let them.
I would murder them all if I could, Silke whispers.
She turns to Vadim. Please, she has an injured hand, be careful. She turns back to Josie.
Josie, I'm right here.
Knowing, though, that she isn't.
Not really. I'm so sorry.
She looks at Boris.
She's just a child, can't he leave her alone?
Not my decision. Anyway, Vadim likes them young. So do I. You're not much older than her, are you?
No.
Silke begins to unbutton her shirt. She knows what to do. The noise of screaming women and shouting men determined to do what they came here for is overpowering. For a moment, Silke wonders if the noise will bring guards, rescuers. None arrive. They are probably just doing the same thing. As Boris explores her body with calloused hands, talking himself up, Silke looks across at Josie. In the flickering light from the stove, she sees Josie's face turned to her, a new level of fear in her eyes. Silke reaches out her hand. A heavily bandaged hand is placed on hers. Hand in hand, with Josie quietly sobbing, their eyes never leaving each other, they survive their ordeal. As Boris is putting his trousers and boots back on, he whispers to Silke,
No one else will touch you, and I can arrange that only Vadim will touch your friend.
Then do.
Come on, boys, if you haven't managed to fuck by now, you're not going to get it up tonight. Out of here. Let these ladies get their beauty sleep. Boris calls out across the room. Groans from the unsuccessful men mingle with the sniggering and laughter of the conquerors, only to be replaced by the sobs of the injured and distressed women. No one speaks. The stink of unwashed, vodka-soaked men is all that is left in the air. As the clanging outside drags the prisoners into a new day, the women rise slowly. Heads down, no one makes eye contact. No chatter. Silka risks a quick glance at Josie. The swelling and bruising on her cheek and around her eye is obvious from where Vadim pressed her down. She thinks about saying something, asking how she is, having a closer look at her facial injuries, asking if she has any others. Josie turns her back on her. She gets the message. Breakfast plays out in the mess hall in silence. The old-timers throw a quick glance at the newcomers, registering the injuries, knowing the cause. They retreat into their own shame, grateful for the fresh bodies that will provide some relief from their assault. As the others leave for work, Silka and Josie remain in their hut. They have been told not to leave until Antonina returns and escorts them to the hospital. Josie returns to her bed and curls up, her face buried. Ice forms on the inside of the windows as the stove cools. Their time alone is mercifully short. Silka can't stand the tension between them. As they enter the hospital waiting room, Antonina takes them to the reception desk. "This one is here to work," indicating Silka, who catches the gist of her words. "The other will have to stay here until the end of the day. I'm not coming back just to get one of them." The woman at the desk reads the pieces of paper handed to her. "Come with me," she beckons. They follow her through the ward into the treatment area. Josie sits on the chair indicated, Silka behind her. The dozen or so beds are all occupied, along with several chairs holding those capable of sitting. Groans of pain escape from several of the patients. They seem to be mainly men, but there are a few women. Silka challenges herself to examine these people, trying to work out where they are injured or what could possibly be wrong with them. For many, it is obvious. Visible wounds exist. Blood seeps through scraps of material masquerading as a bandage or tourniquet. She feels the blankness sliding over her, cold as snow. "Ah, here you are." Silka and Josie see Yelena Georgievna approaching. Josie glances up before returning her eyes to the floor in front of her. "How are you today? How is the pain?" Josie shrugs. The doctor looks from Josie to Silka, who turns away. Yelena gently places her fingers under Josie's chin, forcing her to look up. The injury on her face looks worse, having been stung by the icy walk to the hospital. The doctor brushes her fingers over the damaged area. Josie winces. "Can you tell me what happened?" Josie forces her head down, Yelena releasing her hold.
"It's her fault," Josie spits. "She made me do it, made me go along with it. She calls herself my friend and she did nothing to help me. Just let them."
"Men visited our hut last night," Silka whispers.
"Oh, I see,"
Yelena sighs.
"Do you have any other injuries, Josie?"
Josie shakes her head.
"And what about you, Silka?"
"No."
"Of course she doesn't. She just let him have her, didn't fight, didn't say no."
The doctor stands.
"Stay here. I'm going to try to find a room I can take you both to. I want to examine you further."
Silka and Josie wait in silence. Silka wonders about the doctor. Are people assigned this work in the camps, or do they choose it? She can't imagine anyone wanting to be here. Yelena returns and ushers them into a nearby room. The occupant being taken out is arguing that he should be in a room by himself. He is a senior officer, not to be treated like a prisoner. The bed in the room has the crumpled sheet and blanket of the former occupant and the smell of an unwashed male, stale alcohol and cigarettes.
Yelena has the two girls sit side by side on the bed.
This is a brutal place, says the doctor.
I know, Silke whispers.
She turns to Josie.
Josie, I'm sorry. I should have warned you, told you what to expect, helped you to understand.
You just lay there.
You looked at me.
Silke, how could you?
Silke is still not able to access any feeling, but she notices, distantly, she has started shaking, her knees knocking up and down on the bed. She clutches her hands beneath them.
I'm sure she didn't have a choice, Yelena answers. She could have tried. A friend would have tried.
Josie's voice lowers and fades away.
There are always other things people think she should have done, but it is hardest hearing this from someone she's been trying to let in, become close to. I just hoped it wouldn't happen, Silke says. I knew it would, but I didn't know when, and I just hoped it wouldn't.
She is truly sorry, but she also doesn't know what else she should have done, could have done.
The doctor seems to feel the tension. For now, I want to examine Josie, change her dressing, then I need to get you set up for work here, Silke.
Silke slides off the bed.
Shall I wait outside?
Yelena looks at Josie.
You can stay, she answers, the chill still in her voice.
Silke looks away, holding one hand in another, trying to quell the shaking, as Josie is examined. Bardejov, Czechoslovakia, 1940. Silke and her sister Magda walk down a street in their hometown of Bardejov on a fragrant spring day. Magda smiles at two boys walking towards them. She is 2 years older than Silke, and Silke admires the way she walks, her elegant wrists with her watch glinting in the sunlight, her hips gently swinging.
They both like you, Silke says. Which one do you like the best?
They're just boys, Magda says.
The boys position themselves in front of Silke and Magda, forcing the girls to either stop or walk around them. Magda stops and Silke follows suit.
Hello, Laszlo. Yardin, Magda says. So who's this pretty little thing with you? Laszlo says, his eyes wandering up and down Silke.
She's my sister, my younger sister. Take your eyes off her, Magda snaps.
No boy or man is going to want to take his eyes off her, Laszlo sneers.
Silke's stomach lurches in a confusing way. She looks down at the ground.
Come on, Silke, let's go.
Magda grabs Silke's hand and pulls her away.
Hey, Silke, lose your sister and come and find me, Laszlo calls out.
Magda squeezes Silke's arm.
Ow, stop it, let me go, what's your problem? Silke says, shaking her arm free.
You're only 14, Silke, Magda snaps back at her.
I know how old I am, she says defiantly. He's quite good looking. How well do you know him?
Magda stops, puts her face close to Silke's.
Don't be stupid, Silke. You're just a child. He's not a man, but he's not a boy either. You have to be careful.
Silke brings her arms across her chest.
So I'm never allowed to talk to a boy, is that what you're saying?
No, that's not what I'm saying. One day you'll grow up, then you'll know.
Know what? What do you know about boys? I've never seen you alone with a boy.
Magda looks away, a dark cloud on her beautiful face. Silke has never seen her look this way. Shadows behind her eyes.
Magda, are you all right?
Come on, let's get the shopping done and get home before curfew.
No, why can't we stay out? I don't want to obey such a stupid rule. We haven't done anything wrong.
You can be such a child, Silke.
Do you want to get Papa into trouble because you won't do as you're told? This is so like you, always wanting things your way. This time, little sister, you do as I say and we go home before the curfew.
And if we don't, what will they do to us?
Silke stands still in the warm, scented street. What could possibly happen to them on such a soft spring day?
The Germans. You don't want to know.
How much worse can it get?
Oh, Silke, please, just once believe me when I say we need to do as Papa asks.
Silke and Josie follow the doctor, Yelena Georgievna, to the end of the ward and are introduced to two nurses, both Russian, Raisa Fyodorovna and Lyuba Lukyanovna. They are instructed to teach Silke what is required in filing patient records, making notations and fetching medicine. Raisa is tall and strikingly pale, with large, full lips, and Lyuba is shorter, with almond-shaped eyes and sharp cheekbones. Both have long, dark hair, indicating they are not prisoners. Silke wonders again if they choose to be here or whether they are assigned their positions. Silke and Josie's hair is still short, beginning to curl lightly in the damp air. Both Raisa and Lyuba speak multiple languages too, and Silke is told they will be her main overseers during the 2 weeks. Josie is told she will have to sit in the corner of the room and wait until the end of the day. Two other male doctors are introduced to Silke, told she is in training to be able to record their notes directly as they examine and assess patients. Silke notices the glances they give her, liking what they see. She cringes. Is this place as threatening as Hut 29? Only time will tell. Josie sits on the floor at the back of the large counter that has four chairs to sit and work from. One of the women offers her a chair, which she declines. She is soon curled up asleep, tired, traumatized, in shock. A combination of all three. Silke is a fast learner. She catches on to the format and rhythm of carefully identifying the correct notes for each patient and filing them. She is taken to a small room at the back of the ward and shown the range of medication she will have to correctly write down or collect. Left there to study the names and spelling of each, she works out their varied medicinal benefits. When Raisa comes to get Silke from the dispensary for a meal break, Silke asks her to confirm what she has taught herself. Raisa tells her she is very impressed, particularly with her pronunciation. Another nurse comes in and angrily demands to know what they are doing. Without waiting for an explanation, she orders them from the room. Silke doesn't yet understand the hierarchy, but realizes that here, as with anywhere, she will have to learn who to trust and who to avoid. Taking a seat at the counter, she is handed a tin plate with a sweet bread roll, a piece of potato, and a small quantity of dried green beans.
Is this for me? She asks.
Yes, eat up, Raisa says. We can eat whatever the patients don't. This is what is left over. Many of them are too sick to eat.
Don't they need it to get better?
Some of them won't get better, and we can't force them. If we send it back to the kitchen, the greedy pigs there would only eat it, or sell it. Raisa's lips draw tight in a thin line of distaste. Silke's stomach suddenly feels very small. It wouldn't be the first time she's eaten a dead person's food.
Can I share it with my friend?
If you want, Raisa shrugs. Silke takes the plate and sits down beside Josie, resting against the wall. She gently shakes her awake. Josie sits up, orienting herself to where she is.
Here, eat some of this.
I don't want your food. I don't want anything from you. Josie lies back down and closes her eyes. Silke breaks the bread roll in two and places one half on the floor in front of Josie. Lyuba, the other nurse, comes and sits down beside her.
It's great to have some help.
Oh, I don't know how much help I am yet.
You'll get there. Raisa says you're a fast learner and can already pronounce the names of the drugs better than she can.
I'm good with languages.
Excellent. When you start writing your own reports, you will need to have your spelling 100%. Mostly it doesn't matter, but every now and then we get audited and we all get in trouble if they find incorrect spelling or something left out.
I don't want to get anyone into trouble. Can I show you what I write before it goes on the file?
Of course. That is what I am suggesting. Raisa and I will teach and supervise you, and I think Yelena Georgievna likes you, so you will be fine. She glances at the clock on the wall. It's time to go back to work. Silke looks at Josie and the uneaten piece of bread. It is good, she thinks, that Josie does not just accept her situation. It is a kind of strength. Still, Silke feels the pang of distance. That afternoon, when Silke and Josie are returned to their hut before the others arrive back, they find it in total disarray. All the beds have been stripped of their sheet and blanket, and in many cases tipped upside down or on their side. The meagre belongings of the women lie in heaps on the floor of the hut. Josie, Silke and Antonina stand in the doorway, surveying the mess.
Looks like Klavdia Arsenyevna has been here, Antonina says.
Stepping into the hut, Silke asks quietly,
Are we allowed to clean it up?
You can fix your own bed.
Antonina stands with hands on hips, and Silke notices how strong she is, though with a small frame. The muscles, arms, chest, thighs, bulge roundly out from her joints.
What about the others? Can we do them all while we wait for you to bring the women back?
It's probably better they see for themselves what happens without warning.
But why? Why has someone done this?
Klavdia Arsenyevna is the senior guard for this hut and the larger brigade. She's looking for things you shouldn't have.
We had everything taken from us. How could we have something we're not meant to have?
Josie asks.
She knows that. This is her warning to you, and it might be because she has found out about your job, Silke. You have access to things others don't now. If she finds something she doesn't like, you can expect to be sent to the hole for punishment.
Antonina turns and leaves the hut, letting the door stay open, the icy air being blown in. Josie closes it.
But what does Klavdia not want to find, she thinks. They seem to be allowed to have some possessions.
The rules here change day to day, she thinks. And though this camp has a different purpose, to get them to work for the Soviet Union rather than kill them for being Jewish. In these conditions, and with constant rape, always the threat of violence, and the hole, Silke can see that she has gone from one cruel, inhuman place to another. She goes to the stove and attempts to coax it back to life by gently placing small amounts of coal ash from the bucket on top of the dulling embers. What should they do about the upturned room, she wonders.
I think she was right, she says to Josie. We should leave it for the others to see, and we can tell them what Antonina said.
Josie ignores her and goes to her bed, struggling to write it with one hand.
Here, let me help, Silke says. I don't need your help.
Fine, Silke says harshly. She looks away from the spectacle. Eventually she turns round to see Josie buried under the blanket, her back to her. Day has turned to night. The stove is pumping out as much heat as Silke can get from it when the door opens and the other women stagger in. The solitary light bulb casts eerie shadows over the chaos, making it difficult, at first, for the women to see what they have arrived home to. Slowly, as they each make their way to their beds, it becomes evident. Several of them turn on Silke, who is standing by the stove.
What the fuck have you done? Says Elena.
It hits Silke that she and Josie are about to be blamed.
No, no, it wasn't us. She fights the urge to scream at the woman. See, my bed is the same. This is how we found the place.
Then who did this? Says Hannah.
It was a guard named Klavdia Arsenyevna. Antonina told us about her.
And why?
Silke quickly explains. Hannah looks very pale.
Oh, no.
What is it? Elena asks her. Hannah throws her sheet and blanket and mattress around, looking for something. Elena slaps her, hard and sudden.
It was just a crust, Hannah!
Hannah lets out a sob.
I was saving it for you!
The other women look away, set about restoring their beds, awaiting their call to dinner. After dinner, they return to the hut, a reluctance to go to bed obvious in the way the women linger over even the unsavoury chores. In the brighter light at the mess, Silke had been able to see other injuries from the night before on the faces of some of the women and noticed one held her right arm limply, supporting a painful wrist. Josie still avoids Silke, preferring to talk to Natalia. This fracture in their friendship must be obvious to the other women, but no one comments.
"Do you think they will come again?"
Olga whispers. She's whipping a needle and thread through a small piece of fabric, with hands crooked from overuse and cold. She will unpick her stitches and do them over, perfecting her work several times before bed. No one attempts an answer. With a light off, the outside searchlight throws a diffused shadow that dances around the room as falling snow plays within the beams. The women slowly move onto their own beds. They have learned already the need to be as well rested as possible for the labour they will have to endure tomorrow.
Chapter 6. The 2 weeks of treatment for Josie's hand pass quickly. It heals with the ministrations of Yelena Georgievna, beyond the point at which she should have returned to normal work. The cold continues to intensify, along with the hours of darkness. The women in Hut 29 have got to know each other, or at least become used to each other. Friendships have formed, and shifted, and reformed. Fights have taken place. Josie remains distant, and Silke accepts this. She understands that her role in the hospital might distance her permanently from her hut mates. She supposes she ought to take the job and survive. The reaction of those around her is just something she has to deal with. Some, like Olga and Margareta, have expressed gratitude and already say they are relying on the extra bits of food she brings, the bandages and fabric to keep them warmer. So far, only Elena has expressed hostility. But although she has yelled and hissed at Silke, she hasn't laid a hand on her. The men still visit at night. The women are raped, abused, injured. And there are other indignities. Two have been sent to the hole for misdemeanours, including Hannah, Elena's hanger-on, for simply looking at the guard Klavdia Arsenyevna the wrong way. When she returned, for days afterwards, she was not even able to speak. Yelena smooths cream into Josie's hand before placing it back in her lap. Josie looks down.
"I'm sorry, Josie. It has healed well. I cannot continue to bandage it. In fact, I might compromise it by continuing to wrap it up. It needs to breathe now."
Josie looks around the room, her eyes coming to rest on Silke, who is standing by the doctor. Yelena notices.
"I am sorry, Josie. If I could give you work here, I would, but they only allow so many prisoners to work with us."
She looks genuinely pained. Silke has learned over the past 2 weeks that Yelena is a good person, always doing her best for everyone, but also having to make hard decisions. She can't be seen to be too favourable towards the prisoner patients, for example, in front of the other doctors, as it would be seen as being favourable towards counter-revolutionaries, spies, criminals. With Silke, it can always appear that Yelena is instructing Silke in her work, Raisa and Lyuba too. But Silke does notice they often talk to her quietly, out of earshot of others. She has seen other prisoner nurses and orderlies on the ward, and they are spoken to mostly politely, professionally and directly. "If something changes, I promise I will have Antonina Karpovna bring you to me."
"Yelena Georgievna, please, isn't there any way she can stay on?"
"We have to be very careful, Silke," Yelena says, looking around. "The administrators do not look kindly upon what they call shirkers, people who want to get out of doing their work."
Silke looks at Josie.
"I'm sorry."
Josie huffs.
"Will everyone please stop saying they're sorry that I can now use my hand? This is ridiculous. We should be happy. We should be happy."
Tears roll down her face. Startled by the tone in Josie's voice, Lyuba comes over.
"Are you all right?"
Josie displays her hand to Lyuba.
"I see. It has healed nicely."
A small laugh escapes from Josie.
"Yes, Lyuba,
It has healed nicely, and from now on I'm going to be happy that I can use both my hands. She stands up, pulls her coat tight around herself, and turns to face the door. I'm ready to go. As Silke opens the door for her, a tall man rushes in with a piece of paper in his hand. He clips her shoulder.
Excuse me, he says, looking back at Silke with an apologetic expression as he hurries past. He has dark brown eyes in a pale, elegant face. Silke is not used to a man being polite to her and doesn't reply, but she holds his eyes for a moment before he turns to the desk, to his task. He's in prisoner clothing. As she and Josie head out the door, Silke looks one more time at the man's back. That evening, the sight of Josie's unbandaged right hand receives mixed responses from the other women. Pleased, indifferent. Some are glad of an extra person to help with the task of moving the coal dug from the mines into the trolleys that takes it to waiting trucks and places beyond. In darkness, in snow. At dinner, Josie makes a big deal about holding a piece of bread in one hand, her tin mug in the other. She offers to fetch the coal and grabs a bucket to head out the door. She is stopped by Natalia and told to wait a few days. They don't want her struggling and spilling their precious supply of heat. When the men invade the hut that night, Vadim notices the unbandaged hand. He asks Josie about it, strokes it gently, kisses it. Silke overhears this display of tenderness. These men only treat you with care in order to soften their own image, so you might be more open to them. It is still a selfish act, a trick. Chapter 7. Silke drags her feet the next morning, walking through spotlit darkness to the hospital. She will tell Yelena again that she has been very grateful for this opportunity, but she should return to working in the mines, or digging, or building, anything as difficult as the work her hutmates are being forced to do. She watched Josie walk away from the camp this morning, her body nudging Natalia's. The two of them have become close. A pang of jealousy gripped Silke. The small thaw in Josie yesterday as she showed her her unbandaged hand had given her hope they might regain the closeness they had. In truth, the hospital work has been challenging and draining, despite her fortune in being indoors. Not only does she have to communicate in Russian and the Cyrillic script, and learn to understand the established ethics, relationships and hierarchies, but most of all, she has to deal with the unexpected reactions of her body and mind to being around the sick and dying. She has managed to hide, she hopes, what is going on, but Raisa did mention the other day that it was amazing how Silke was not at all squeamish. That she could be around blood and bone and waste without ever flinching. Raisa, who had been sent here after graduating, Silke found out, said it had taken her months to become used to seeing bodies in these various states of disease, injury and malnutrition. Silke hated the mixture of horror and fascination on Raisa's face. She shrugged, turned away, said in a monotone, I guess some of us are just like that. But the job is distracting her from her troubles too. Always a new problem to solve, something new to learn. If she did continue working here, it would almost feel like a life, a way of keeping herself shut off from the memories of the past and the horror of her present situation. Yelena is occupied when Silke gets in, and Lyuba and Raisa understand her mood and conspire to keep her busy and take her mind off Josie. Silke is grateful for their efforts. Come with me, Lyuba beckons Silke to follow her, to where a male doctor is standing at a bedside. She has seen him working around the ward and has been briefly introduced, by first name and patronymic, Yuri Petrovich. The patient is unconscious, his wounds obvious, the bandage around his head soaked with blood. Silke stands silently behind doctor and nurse, peering round to watch the examination taking place. The blanket is pulled up from the bottom of the bed, A needle is rammed firmly into the heel of one of his pale, lifeless feet. Blood spurts out, covering the sheet. There is no reflexive movement from the man. The doctor turns to Silke, handing her a clipboard, bypassing Liuba. Liuba nods encouragingly and stands beside her.
No movement from foot on needle prick.
Silke writes, after first glancing at a clock at the end of the ward to record the exact time of her notation. Liuba whispers to her whenever she pauses, uncertain. Silke is concentrating hard. The bleeding foot is covered. The doctor walks to the top of the bed and roughly stretches the patient's right eye open, then covers his face.
Pupils fixed and dilated, Silke writes next. Slight pulse, irregular.
Again, noted. Turning to Silke, Yuri Petrovich speaks quietly.
Do you know how to feel for a pulse in the neck?
Yes,
Silke replies with confidence.
Good, good. Show me.
Silke pulls the blanket away from the man's face, mimicking what she has seen. She places two fingers under the curve of the jaw, applying pressure. She feels the flutter of a faint pulse.
Check on him every 15 minutes, and when you can no longer feel anything, declare him dead and let the porter know. Make sure you note the time in the record.
Yes, Yuri Petrovich, I will.
He turns to Liuba. She's a quick learner. We may as well use her. They don't give us enough nurses to have them checking on patients filling beds by taking too long to die. Make sure you sign off on what time she records. He nods at Silke and Liuba and then moves off to another part of the ward.
I've got to check on a patient, Liuba says. You'll be fine.
She walks off. Silke looks at the clock, working out exactly when it will be 15 minutes since she noted the words slight pulse, irregular. She is still standing by the bedside when Yelena walks up to her and asks her what she's doing. When she explains, Yelena smiles reassuringly.
You don't have to wait by the bed. You can go and do other things. Just come back every now and then and don't worry if it's not exactly 15 minutes. All right?
Oh, thank you. I thought I had to stay here until he died.
You're really not afraid of death, are you? Silke drops her head, the image of a pile of emaciated bodies flashing through her mind, their desperate final sounds, the smell of it.
No, I've been around it enough.
The words slip out.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yelena pauses.
How old are you again?
19.
Yelena's brow furrows.
One day, if or when you feel up to it, please know you can talk to me about it.
Before Silke can answer, Yelena walks off. On her third visit to the dying patient, a prisoner who had an accident while working outside, Silke writes the time and the words, no pulse. She takes a moment to pause and force herself to look at the face of the man she has just declared dead. She flicks back through the paperwork, searching for his name. Bending down as she covers his face, she whispers,
Ivan Detuchkin, Alav Hashalom.
May peace be upon him. She has not uttered these words in a long time. Auschwitz-Birkenau, summer 1943.
What did he say to you? We want to hear every word, and did he look at you while he was talking? Tell us, Gita, we need to hear.
Silke sits on the grass at the side of Block 25 with her friends Gita and Dana. Magda is resting inside. It is a Sunday afternoon, summer, with no wind to carry the ashes spewing from the nearby crematoria their way. Silke, in her position as block leader, has been allowed some freedom of movement. But Lale is the only male prisoner they've ever seen inside the women's camp. That morning, he had appeared. The girls knew what to do to lessen the risk for their friends, encircle Gita and Lale, giving them just enough privacy for a whispered conversation. Silke had strained to hear and had caught snippets. Now she wanted the detail.
He was asking me about my family, Gita replies. And what did you say? Silke asks.
I didn't want to talk about them.
I think he understood, so he told me about his.
And? Has he got brothers and sisters?
Dana asks. He has an older brother called Max.
I love that name. Max, Silke says, putting on a gushy, girly voice.
Sorry, Silke, Max is married and has two small boys of his own, Geeta tells her.
Oh well, never mind. What else did he say?
He has a sister. Her name is Goldie and she is a dressmaker. I could tell he really loves his mama and sister.
That's good, isn't it?
That's very good, Geeta.
You want to love someone who is good to the other women in his life, says Dana, mature beyond her years.
Who said anything about being in love? Geeta throws back at her.
Geeta loves Lali.
Silke sings songs to her friends, letting the sunlight and their friendship momentarily block out the horror surrounding them.
Stop it, both of you, Geeta says, but she is smiling.
Exhausted by hope, the three young women lie on the grass and close their eyes, letting the warmth of the sun transport them away from where they are. That afternoon, as Silke is putting on her coat, readying to leave the warmth of the hospital and face the freezing temperatures outside, she sees Yelena.
Yelena Georgievna, I need to talk to you.
Silke, I've been looking for you. Yes, let's talk.
Before Silke can say anything, Yelena continues. My colleagues are impressed with you. They asked if you had any nursing experience.
No, I told you. I've never been a nurse.
That's what I told them. We chatted about you and we were wondering whether you would like to train to be a nurse.
This was all happening so fast.
How can I do that? I'm a prisoner here.
What better way to learn nursing than by doing it?
I'll be your teacher. I'm sure the other nurses will help and be grateful for the extra pair of hands. What do you say?
I don't know. Yelena Georgievna, I don't know if I belong here.
Yelena puts a hand on Silke's shoulder. Silke tries not to flinch at the intimacy of the touch.
I know I don't know you very well, Silke, but you are good at this and we would like your help. Will you think about it?
Yelena smiles warmly, like a sister. Silke swallows. She can hardly bear it. The guilt she feels is overwhelming. She thinks of her hut mates after they come in, huddling by the stove, unwrapping wet fabric from their frozen feet, groaning. But she also thinks of Olga's face when she hands her the real tea she has just boiled on the stove. This is a terrible decision and she doesn't know why. Again, she has been singled out.
Can I ask, Yelena Georgievna, why you are here?
You mean what did I do to be assigned this position in Vorkuta?
Silke nods slowly.
Believe it or not, Silke, I volunteered to be here.
She lowers her voice.
My family always believed in a greater good.
She nods to the sky. It is forbidden to talk about religion, but Silke understands what she is getting at.
My parents devoted their lives to helping others. In fact, my father died doing so, fighting a fire. I try to honour them by carrying on their mission.
That's very good of you, Silke says. She feels overwhelmed.
Although, Yelena says, her brow creasing, I must admit I did believe broadly in the project of the Soviet Union, the motherland calling and all that, but it is quite different to be here.
Silke sees her turn to look back at the people lying in the beds behind them.
I'd best stop talking now, she says, and pulls her face back into a smile.
Thank you, Yelena Georgievna, for telling me, and I just hope the women in my hut can find better work too. And soon.
I understand. I do too, Yelena says. See you tomorrow.
Yelena takes her hand off Silke's shoulder, goes to leave. Silke remains facing her.
Is there something else, Silke?
Josie, could Josie do my clerical job?
Yelena thinks for a moment or two.
Not just yet.
Maybe if we can use you full-time as a nurse, we will bring Josie here. But will she be able to learn?
I'll teach her. She'll be all right.
It is a risk, thinks Silke. If Josie can't pick up the tasks, the language, as quickly as Silke, will she be punished? A punishment worse even than going back to outside labour.
We'll see,
Yelena says, and walks away.